Right. I mean, the meeting today is packed. I'm going to speak for half an hour on the beyond the glass ceiling, in other words, beyond getting equality within the capitalist system.
Right. Now, we couldn't quite manage to arrange the meeting on the International Women's Day, which was the 8th of March, but I find that by chance that this is Mother's Day, so I thought, well, maybe that's the next best thing. The International Women's Day, from their website, honours the suffragettes and celebrates women's successes, plus draws attention to the inequities that have still got to be overcome. This is the 101st year of the International Women's Day. It was suggested by Clara Zetkin, who was the leader of the Women's Office in the Social Democratic Party in Germany, in interestingly, at a conference in Copenhagen in 1910, and this was the second international conference of working women, and there were women from 17 countries representing unions, socialist parties, and interestingly, there were three women MPs there from the Finnish Parliament, their first MPs. Anyway, Clara proposed the annual Women's Day in every country to press for their demands. This afternoon I intend looking at the position now, looking perhaps at some of the progress that's been made towards equality with men, and I will include changes that have happened in daily lives and also ideas about women and class before getting on to socialism. Right then, so the glass ceiling is a metaphor for the unseen barrier which prevents women getting to the top in their careers, to the top jobs. And the concerns of the women who are in that position of likely to be able to get those jobs is shared by the government, who commissioned a review into how such obstacles could be removed so that more women could reach those board positions. The resulting Davis report was published in February last year, and that proposed that there should be quotas at boardroom level. The numbers, in fact, have crept up so that the FTSE companies now have 15% women on all of the boards, and I think they're more non-executive directors, because last year a third of all the board appointees have been women. Cameron has expressed interest in quotas if the numbers don't accelerate. So you might ask why there is this interest in the numbers of women in the top jobs. Of course, that the numbers at the top, it reflects them that those who are at slightly lower levels, those who are described as being in the pipeline. But Cameron said the failure to unlock the potential of women in the labour market, besides failing the individual, is failing the economy. And the idea is expressed by some that economic growth is driven by women. Studies in the US have shown that companies with the highest representation of women in the top management teams delivered a higher return on equity and higher return to shareholders than companies with the lowest representation of women. But I don't know anything more about that research as to what other factors are involved. There's also the factor of the women who've had expensive educations, as it were, and getting a return on that investment. Because 50% of women who are in low-paid part-time jobs are working beneath their potential. I'll put another way, 500,000 women who are qualified in science, engineering and technology don't work in those sectors. The concerns, of course, are political as well as economic. The coalition has been losing support amongst women, and maybe because of the effect of spending cuts on female employment. But Cameron has appointed a woman, one Laura Trott, to advise on how his policies, should be dressed up to appeal to women. Governments have a sort of a split personality. They have to run the country in the interests of those who own it. They also need electoral support. So in the context of this talk, I'm going to tell you things that I know that you all already know, but in the context of the talk, I want to state them. In other words, this is capitalism, and the means of production are owned by the minority capitalist class, while the majority working class are dependent upon employment or benefits in order to have access by way of money, of course, to what is produced. There's a wide range of income within the working class, and some imagine them to be in some other different middle class, because perhaps because of the size of their incomes or maybe enhanced lifestyles. The engine that drives the system is sale and profit, and there's a tussle of competing interests both between the capitalists and between workers over employment and so on. Plus, of course, governments aren't able to control the system. So on the one hand, we have the government talking about quotas to enable more women to sit in boardrooms, while at the same time you have spending cuts that are hitting jobs, particularly in the public sector, where 40% of those employed are women. Shouldn't, of course, forget, I suppose, that more women in top jobs means fewer men there. So, what's been the progress since the heady days of the feminist campaigns of the 70s? And they wouldn't all have been termed feminists at that time. How much progress has then been made towards fulfilling their aims? At the time, it was known as the Women's Liberation Movement, but it wasn't a single unified movement. There was political left-wing aims, reformists about particular problems, and feminist aims. The original four demands were formulated at the first National Women's Conference, which was at Ruskin College in 1970, but they were not adapted by the movement as a whole, and those four demands were for equal pay, equal education and opportunity, 24-hour nurseries, free contraception and abortion on demand. So what about progress towards equal pay and opportunities? You had in the 70s the Equal Pay Act, of course, in 1975, which was later amended to include work of equal value, a Sex Discrimination Act, an Employment Protection Act, which made it illegal to dismiss a woman who became pregnant. Other factors to mention here are the strike of women machinists at Ford's, who objected to having their work regraded as being less skilled, and which meant them to getting 87% of the male rate. Also, Britain joined the European Union in 1973, and an article in the Treaty of Rome specified that men and women should receive equal pay for equal work. Well, what's happened? The pay gap between men and women has narrowed from 29% in 1975 down to 10% for those in full-time work. And like all of these things, there's different ways of measuring it, which comes up with different percentages. There's nearly 500,000 equal pay cases outstanding at the present time. Now, according to the Home Office, the reasons for the pay gap are, well, there's the different industries and occupations where women work, the differences in years of full-time work, and each of those differences account for about 20%, more than 20% of the difference. There's also the effect of having previously worked part-time or time out to have a family. That's about 16%. There's a tiny percentage that's due to education. But 36% is not explained by any of these factors and is probably down to discrimination. But it's not necessarily direct discrimination. And I'm using here an example of what happened at Hull University. They had a research review that was published, a spring review, in this year. And the man who approved the final version didn't notice the gender imbalance in the document until it was pointed out to him by a woman who hadn't been mentioned in the document. But the point, she was told, well, they'd featured professors, and because this woman isn't a professor. But she is the lead academic on the conference that's being held there this year on sustainable development research. The co-chairman is mentioned, who happens to be a professor, but the work of, you know, her work hasn't been recognised. And she says, well, perhaps people tend to select people who they think they can get along with for whatever job or task they have in mind. But then goes on to say, it's not very obvious how reasonable allowance could be made from family encumbrances, and cites the case of a woman who had a child sort of a bit later in life, as it goes. But she had to leave the profession because she couldn't keep up with the work and the baby. But it's not helped by her partner being a professor in Southampton. So, you know, because of the career sort of prospects, then at one time it would have been, well, the woman went where the man's work was. But, you know, in order to get along in their careers, that doesn't work. Women who have had their children sort of earlier in their careers, they're still lecturers, while the university is hiring professors who are much younger. And elsewhere, I find it says that having children knocks a hole in a woman's earning capacity, from city high flyer to the school dinner lady. And it sort of says something about where such an important thing as children, where that is in importance. Because one of the four aims was for 24-hour nurseries, which, you know, to enable women to have more working opportunity. But I'd heard recently in Denmark they have these nurseries where people with degrees in, and I think they're called something like pedagogic, can't think of the other word, but they look after the children, you know, and you have these work people, I can't think of the word, qualified, academically qualified to look after the children while the parents are both working, so a high proportion of the population is working. Though I'm told that the holidays are longer, and but they have time to spend with the children then. But it's interesting to look back at the attitudes to women working. It's now considered normal for both partners, whether married or not, to be working, including mothers. Married women formerly were not expected to work, or not when they had a child. I mean, of course, poor women always worked. But in 1931, 30% of the workforce were women, but only 16% of that number were married. Incidentally, at that time, more than 23% of the working women were employed as domestic servants. The Beveridge Report in 1942 said that during marriage, most women would not be gainfully employed. Marriage was actually a bar to work in some jobs, in teaching until 1944, and the civil service, I think, until 1946, and in various other commercial organisations, like Brian and Mays didn't employ married women, except that women kept their marriage secret so they could carry on. Wartime, of course, is different. In World War II, there were state-run nurseries but they didn't cover the whole of the working day, so that there was private childcare arrangements increased. Part-time working was allowed as a concession, but it remains a permanent feature of women's labour. Women worked in factories, and there was conscription of women at the time. In the years following the war, there was a sizeable increase of women in office work and service industries. In the post-war period, women generally weren't seeking employment until at least the younger child went to school. Even by 1961, only 20% of all married women were employed. By 2000, the figure had reached 73%. And some 6 years later, 71% of mothers, married or equivalent, were working, but twice as likely to be doing part-time work. Now, the numbers of men and women working is almost equal, but of course there is the effect of unemployment. So we've seen a breaking down of traditional roles, the move away from the idea of the man as the breadwinner, winner even, and the woman's place being in the home. The economic role of the housewife has diminished and the term is shunned. Women are more independent, with marriage no longer seen as the main or the only option. On the other hand, there's a deal of uncertainty as well. Fathers, it is said, take a greater role in caring for their children. UK fathers in two-parent families on average spend a quarter of the childcare activities during the week and more at weekends. But women still spend twice as much time on childcare as men. And I said about the uncertainties, one example is the proportion of single-parent households, which is now one in four families with dependent children are single-parent households, and around 10% of that number are fathers. And more than half of those live below what the government considers to be the poverty line. No wonder there's pressure on them to get to work. At the time of in the 70s of the women's liberation movement, the family was seen by some as being sort of in the way of the revolution, as maintaining the system. Now, there's been the last half of the last century an unprecedented rise in living standards, an increase in the variety of goods because of developments in technology and mass production techniques that brought goods within reach of most people. I mean, the factors were also improvements in wages and to incomes. There's changes in housework. A dramatic rise in ownership of things like televisions and washing machines in the 60s and in the 70s. So gone is the weekly wash, sort of taking up a Monday. But people have more clothes, so that's another factor. But also there are changes in materials. Gone are the days when pleats had to be sewn in before, you know, the gym slip or whatever was washed. Otherwise, the pleats wouldn't be there afterwards. They had to be ironed in. And that's something else that occurred to me was thinking back to my childhood. Long gone are the flock mattresses. So bed making was more of a chore, with the mattress having to be sort of raked out and so on was a harder thing to do. But by 1985, things like fridges had dropped out of the statistics, and then there were freezers as well, adding to changes in shopping. I mean, before the 60s, people went shopping on foot or public transport, but now it's by car and the internet, of course. By 1997, more than three quarters of food was bought from supermarkets, and then there are, of course, extended hours for shopping. And there are, of course, ready-prepared ingredients and meals and differences of how meals are eaten in many homes. Since the early 60s, the number of people sitting down to Sunday lunch has halved, and a number of people choose not to have even a dining table. So homes are more comfortable, but there's less time to spend in them, with leisure activities adding to the pressure on time and pockets. Living is expensive. There are raised expectations and possibilities are sort of in everyone's face, as it were. But you can own this, what's called stuff, and still be poor. The cuts to security and welfare benefits will hit women, according to the Fawcett... they'll hit men as well, of course, but their accent is on women. The Fawcett Society says that a fifth of female wage consists of benefits, They're in low-wage dominated sectors like care and retail, but only a tenth of the male wage is attributed to benefits. The latest unemployment figures show another increase in part-time jobs, some of which is accounted for by workers having their hours cut. But the basis of the system remains the same. So moving on, or back, as it were, there was another factor in the some elements in the women's movement was criticism of Marx and Engels for saying that going to work had to do with liberation. Plus, also, there was disagreement with the analysis of class of women. Women said to be a caste rather than a class. So let's look at what Marx actually said. And here I should say I don't go with the view that we are dependent on what Marx said about different things, but I think that this is a case where it's as well to point out what he did actually say. Now, he described the breakup of old family relations and said that large-scale industry had given women and children a decisive role to be fulfilled outside the home, building the new economic foundation for a higher form of the family and of the relation between the sexes. But, I mean, for goodness sake, when he was saying this was in the 19th century, and he was aware at the time of what the conditions were like. And he said, at a time where he said, where a worker exists for the process of production instead of the process of production existing for the worker. Within capitalism, this situation was a pestilential source of corruption and slavery. But under suitable conditions, it cannot fail to be transformed into a source of human progress. Engels also, he pointed out that the emancipation of women becomes feasible only when women are enabled to take part extensively in social production and when domestic duties require their attention in a minor degree. And on the other view, that the Marxist class analysis doesn't fit women. Look at the Anne Oakley, who wrote in The Subject of Women, that the interests of men and women at all levels are potentially in conflict, that all women are oppressed. And I mean, this wasn't just her view, this was a view of and a view now of feminists. And the claim that the analysis of capital rules out those embedded in domestic economy. Women don't have the same relationship to the means of production as men. They are concentrated in specific occupations, particularly low-paid white-collar work. Because out of this comes the idea that the end of capitalism wouldn't end the oppression of women, since that predates capitalism. So, of course, do war and poverty. So let's look again at the definition of capitalism, where a privileged minority owns the land, industry, communications, transport, and so on, the means of production. The vast majority doesn't own the means of production and needs to sell their mental and physical energies in return for wages or salaries, and they do so to the benefit of the capitalist class. Put simply, they're paid less in wages and salaries than what is produced. Now, this has to be understood as a class concept. The working class does all of the jobs necessary as a class, and as a class produces value. And this sort of explains, really, the role of the housewife when the man is the breadwinner. The wage is to enable the man to be fit to go to work, but also to produce the next generation. And that's it. Women fit into that. And I recall being at a meeting in Islington, and I think it was a debate with a woman, and I don't remember the organisation, but a woman in the audience, who I thought at the time ought to know, have known better, she, on this question of the production of surplus value, she asked, well, which part of the child is the surplus value? You know, it's sort of extraordinary, as I say, it was a woman who I thought ought to know better. Now, women are not in some separate, not some women's class or caste, and that view doesn't ignore the fact that the oppression of some sections of the working class is more intensive than others. But the majority of women belong to the class that doesn't own the means of production, the class that needs to sell the mental and physical energies in return for a wage or salary, or dependent on state benefits. Or both, of course. The Fawcett Society, again, says that a fifth of the female wage consists of benefits because, again, of the low wages in female-dominated sectors. For men, it's a tenth of the male wage that's in benefits. But it is the class relationship that points the way forward to what we mean, actually, when we say... gave the title to the meeting to Beyond the Glass Ceiling. We weren't looking at ways of women to be able to get, promotion to the top job, or having more women, in MPs or whatever. What we mean is that women have an equal opportunity to join with men to consciously organise to take the political action to end capitalism, to end class rule, to make a fundamental change in the way production and distribution is organised. In other words, for a system of common ownership and democratic control on behalf of the whole worldwide community. And I have to say, I've been rather parochial, not talking about the problems of women in or men in other countries. So that with socialism, with the means of production owned in common, women and men would have the same relationship to the means of production. There would be a true equality of condition, with free access according to need. But such a change needs majority action, needs women and men. I said about the International Women's Day honouring suffragettes, and I think it's interesting that this party, formed by men and women, without leaders, with a democratic organisation, with its aim of the emancipation of all mankind, or as we might say now, humankind. Socialism is by definition democratic, and therefore the means to achieve have to be democratic. In other words, has to be majority understanding. So why did the early members of the party oppose the suffragettes campaign? Now, both the suffragists, it was the constitutional organisation, and the militant suffragettes, who were formed in 1903, sought the vote on the same basis as men. Suffrage was on the property basis, that was the £10 franchise. And there was still plural voting for the wealthy. But a third of men didn't qualify for the vote. So if women had got the vote on the same basis as men, far fewer women would have qualified. In other words, it's described as votes for rich women. Certainly, they in their propaganda, these women, that they hoped that they could look after the poorer women when they got the vote. But now, the party was never opposed to women having the vote, and said that we are of necessity universal adult suffragists. But in a reply to a letter from Evelyn Pethick Lawrence, who from the Women's Social and Political Union, it said that working class consciousness, understanding the basis of the system, was the important matter. And when the women workers have organised themselves into a political force, the extension of the franchise to cover women workers and that great body of voteless males will be effected without difficulty. If indeed the capitalist class, dismayed by this rapidly growing organisation, have not enacted a measure of complete enfranchisement in the hope it might stay the progress. And later articles, there was no quarrel with the abstract proposal that women should have an equal part with men in politics. It was a different matter to advising working class women to join the franchise agitation at the time. Working women certainly took part in the agitation, but it was considered that they were being used, as indeed the working class was used in the early part of the 19th century, before the 1832 Reform Bill. And in another article, it said that just as household suffrage was, this was after the failure of a reform bill at the time, but household suffrage was inevitable. They now believe that in the march of events, adult suffrage was bound to come. And later that same year, there was a question about adult suffrage. And figures were given to illustrate the fact that the working class was actually in the majority. The men who actually had the vote were a majority of the electorate at the time, by 3-1. But whilst adult suffrage would be a useful measure to enable more quickly and completely to take control of political power, that the working class had a franchise wide enough for the initial steps of their emancipation. It was not the business of a socialist party to spend time and energy in advocating the extension of that franchise. And when the war came, the First World War, the suffragettes like Emily Pankhurst and others, they became what the standard required as recruiting sergeants. In other words, they supported the war, supported the employment of women in the factories and so on. For the party, the emancipation of all mankind, irrespective of sex, removes all the obstacles to the free development of men and women. The worth of a weapon depends on the use made of it. And ask the question, is it the ambition of working women of the advanced school merely to imitate the men? Well, I don't know quite what they meant by the advanced school, but unfortunately the answer has been yes, that women have used their vote in precisely the same way as men. Now, on discrimination, I said about things being just the way that they are. So, looking forward to a time of common ownership and democratic control, so that just the way things are is a time of equality of condition, when there are jobs to be done either inside the home or outside the home of equal value, and where one anticipates that children wouldn't be seen as encumbrances harming career prospects. So with that, I leave it to discussion, perhaps, to have a further look at what might be the situation. But I repeat that women have the equal opportunity with men to organise to end capitalism and establish socialism. Right.